Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hi, this is Ed Camaro, and this month on Fire Marshal's Corner, we're starting a new series where we're going to be taking a look at the groundbreaking project Vision 2020. At the forum that was held in D.C. in April, they came up with five specific strategies to focus on. So over the next few months, we're going to be taking a look each month at each strategy and interviewing the person or the organization that's going to be facilitating that. So this month, we're starting with Alan Perdue from the International Association of Fire Chiefs Fire and Life Safety Section, and he's going to be talking about Strategy 1. Well, the rest of the show is going to really focus on the economic impact on the fire service. We all are very aware of the crisis that's happening across the country, and what kind of impact is happening on the fire service. In some places, it's very devastating. Other places, not as bad, but everybody's feeling it, and we're going to talk to a few people to learn more about how it's impacting them and others across the nation. We're going to be talking with Sean DeCrane, who's a battalion chief with the Cleveland Fire Department and a member of the International Association of Firefighters, Division Chief and Fire Marshal Mike Love with Montgomery County Fire and Rescue, and Chief Bill Metcalf with the North County Fire Protection District out in California. And he's also a treasurer for the International Association of Fire Chiefs. So all these people bring a really unique perspective to the whole issue of the economic impact on the fire service. So with that, let's get right into Fire Marshal's Corner. Okay, joining us now is Alan Perdue, who's the Director of Emergency Services for the Guilford County in North Carolina. And Alan's also on the Board of Directors for the International Association of Fire Chiefs Fire and Life Safety Section. Thanks for joining us, Alan.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
We're going to be talking about Vision 2020, which is a project you've been hearing a lot about for it was funded under a Department of Homeland Security grant, and we're taking a look at how to reduce loss of life and property from fire across the country. And it's been going on for over a year now, and we've had a series of webinars and a large forum down in D.C. that Alan was a part of. And what has emerged out of this whole project are five different strategies that everybody identified as really key to trying to reduce the loss of life and property in this country. And for each of the strategies, an organization has stepped forward to kind of be the facilitator for that one and shepherd it and move it forward. And so the first one we're going to talk about is Strategy 1, which is a national agenda. Which is Strategy 1, increasing advocacy for fire prevention. And the IFC Fire and Life Safety Section has stepped forward to help that one along. And Alan Perdue is going to be the contact person on that. So, Alan, I was wondering if maybe you could fill us in on what you see as your vision for working with this strategy.
Sure. Our strategy is increasing advocacy for fire prevention. And the IFC Fire and Life Safety Section is honored to be able to facilitate this this important part of this project. The Vision 2020 project is a significant step for the fire service to take prevention and education to the forefront of America. One of the issues we have here in America is fire is not real, and part of our goal in this is to make fire real in America.
Now, when you say fire is not real, do you mean to the general public they just don't perceive it as a problem?
I think the general public, the policymakers, and other stakeholders many times. And I was thinking the other day, if you took the book or the reports, America Burning, and America Burning Revisited, and the many reports, and put them in a library, how many times would they be checked out by people that weren't already a member of the fire service?
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a problem that, you know, communities face everywhere that, you know, crime is perceived as a real and immediate problem. But when a fire happens and somebody is killed or a family is misplaced, it's always just looked at as an accident, isn't it?
That's correct. And until it happens to you or someone that you know personally, it's not in the forefront of your mind. So one of the things we want to do as a part of this project is to elevate the significance of the devastation, the deaths and injuries that take place every day across America.
So how are you looking at doing this? You've mentioned a kind of what I thought was a very innovative, well, maybe not innovative, but a very good way of managing this whole project and applying kind of what we do every day.
Right, working with members of our board have discussed using the incident command system as a way to structure how we attack this problem. We do that day in and day out on fire scenes and other natural disasters. We need to treat this problem in the same situation. There's various aspects of advocacy that many, many people are here to assist us with. We have a large list of volunteers that have stepped up to be involved in this. So using the ICS system with a unified command, we're looking at possibly breaking this down into bite-sized pieces. One of the segments may be residential sprinklers, fire injuries, fire deaths. One that we talked about this past weekend in Washington, D.C. at the IFC Strategic Planning was wildfire and the issues we continue to face with that particular component of our service and the prevention and code development we need to do in that arena.
I don't know if you have the action items listed in front of you. I'd just kind of like to go down them here, and maybe you could comment on each of them. There are about five of them here. And just see what, you know, maybe where we're going to be going with this in the course of this project. The first one that came, again, this is all in the report, which anybody can download. It's at www.strategicfire.org. Again, that's www.strategicfire.org. You can download the report and get what I'm talking about here. But one of the first action items is to document and communicate the magnitude of the nation's fire problem and the benefit of prevention activities to decision makers. And I think, you know, we were talking about this earlier, is people just don't perceive fire as a large-scale problem. I think probably because a lot of it just happens in the ones and the twos on the local level.
That's exactly right. And unfortunately, if you look at during tough economic times, such as we're in right now, when departments face budget cuts, oftentimes prevention bureaus take the hit first. And if you really look at it, for every dollar that you spend on prevention and planning and preparedness saves you $5 to $7 down the road when the emergency occurs. And that's one of the things we've got to get across is how vital and important that proactive stance is versus reactive. We still need the response mechanism in place as all hazard response agencies, but we've got to take a bigger role in preventing these incidents when many, many cities and counties are faced with significant budget issues.
And that's actually what we're talking about in the other segments of today's show is the economic impact. And so often, you know, when a department or a city manager or a mayor has to make a choice, that often when it comes down to putting the trucks on the street or fire prevention programs, we all know who generally loses in that battle right there. It's fire prevention.
That's exactly right, and we've got to change that perception.
Yeah. Well, the second action item here is improve and support data collection systems. And this has actually been a common theme through all five strategies about how weak our data system really is right now when it comes to either collecting it or reporting it in a meaningful manner to everybody so they can use it to make the cases that you're talking about.
That's right. Policymakers look for data to make informed decisions. And one of the things we're going to advocate is enhancing the reporting system that currently exists. It captures a lot of data, but there are other parts of it that we need to do. And I often say if you don't measure it, you can't evaluate it. Mm-hmm. And we've got to be able to evaluate the impact that we're making.
Mm-hmm. The next one is develop a current national fire prevention research agenda. You know, there just doesn't seem to be the breadth of research into prevention aspects that there really could be to have the effectiveness we're hoping for.
That's exactly right. The prevention side is back to performance measures and looking at is what we're doing working? Is it having an impact? And it takes research oftentimes to take a look at that. The other side is looking at it from a code development standpoint, putting research into like a project we recently did working with Underwriters Laboratories through a grant process and engineered lightweight construction. Scientific data that helps us make the right decision for the next step.
Well, the next one's probably the most timely one of all, given that we just went through the election and there's going to be a change in administration. Advocate for increased focus and leadership of the U.S. Fire Administration and we're going to be getting a new fire administrator. We're not sure when, obviously, but as it always happens with the change of administration, we'll get new leadership at USFA. And really, here's a pretty unique opportunity to try to get somebody in there with a real strong fire prevention focus, isn't there?
That's right. We've made some significant headway with Chief Cade since his appointment, and we would certainly like to encourage the president and his staff as they make these appointments to continue to select an individual that can carry that message forward and continue what we've built over the last year to 18 months. Mm-hmm. It's critical that the next U.S. Fire Administrator understand prevention and be an advocate for us in pushing this concept.
And then we get on to developing a clearinghouse for prevention activities, resources, and best practices. And this was quite a bit of discussion, too, that, boy, there's a lot of great work going on out there, but unfortunately nobody just knows about it, do they?
That's exactly right. The Fire Service has tremendous programs across the United States, but oftentimes we don't have them all in one place. They're not cataloged where an individual can find that particular project or process that can help them address a problem in their community. I think this ties very heavily into the reporting and data collection. Being able to identify what is a fire problem in your community may not be the same problem in my community, but we need to make sure we have the tools and resources available to help every department across America.
And with the economic tough times that we were just talking about, you know, here's a great chance to leverage what somebody else has done. You know, why reinvent the wheel?
That's right. We often borrow programs and modify, enhance them to fit our current need, and a lot of times it's just being able to identify that someone's already started the process.
Yeah, one of the best definitions I heard about R&D was actually, everybody thinks it's research and development. It actually stands for rip off and duplicate.
That's true.
So why not use what somebody's using successfully somewhere else, you know? And then the last one we get down to, again, an extremely timely action item is increase awareness of the economic impact of fire loss. And our good friend Ozzie Murkoff sure has been beating this drum about really emphasizing that whole thing, that just a lot of people don't realize how much damage fire does beyond the loss of life and injury.
That's right. Ozzie's done a good job of showing the direct and indirect cause to fire. Oftentimes it's looked at, and again, this ties back to data, you know, property loss from fire, but the indirect cost is very significant across this nation when you look at what it costs to respond to the fire. And one of the other areas that continues to evolve is the green effect of fire in America, and what can we do by installing suppression systems and other things to do our part in that arena.
Right. So I think there's a lot of ways that we can start reaching out and being creative and looking at different avenues. And you brought up a great one right there, the green issue as well. I mean, that's obviously a growing dynamic concern, and there's no reason that fire shouldn't be using that as part of its mission as well.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, one of the things that we want to do as a part of this process is reach out to our non-traditional partners in fire and life safety and start getting them on board to help champion the message into the different groups, different arenas, and really help make fire real for the person on the street so that they understand what we're facing day in and day out, understand why we need the resources we do, and then help us ultimately achieve the goal we're after of reducing fire injuries and fire deaths.
Well, we've been talking with Alan Perdue, who's with the International Association of Fire Chiefs Fire and Life Safety Section Board of Directors, and that group's going to be facilitating Strategy 1 of Vision 2020, and that strategy is to increase advocacy for fire prevention. So we really appreciate you joining us today, Alan.
Glad to do it anytime.
And we'll be revisiting this in a few more months when you know, you've had a chance to do some work in this area and get things going, just to get a kind of a progress report and see where we stand. So thanks for taking the time and joining us.
All right. Thank you. And we look forward to working with many folks on this arena.
Okay. My name's Ed Camo, and you're listening to Fire Marshal's Corner on radio at firehouse.com.
radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Well, joining us now on Fire Marshal's Corner is Sean DeCrane, who's a battalion chief with the Cleveland Fire Department, and he's also a member of the IFF, International Association of Firefighters, and Mike Love, who's a division chief and the fire marshal with Montgomery County Fire and Rescue. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Hey, our pleasure to be here.
Glad to be here, Ed. Thank you.
Well, as we're recording this, the election has happened, which is hallelujah. We're glad for that two-year odyssey to be over. But the real focus of that election has unquestionably been the economy. We're all seeing the very negative impacts of the economy lately in just so many different areas, the housing and the banking and all that stuff. But what we're going to really focus on here today is the impact that all of this is having on the fire service. It's having some pretty big impact across the country. And maybe we can start with you, Sean, if you can talk about what you're seeing from your perspective, not only in Cleveland, but also, you know, what's IFF seeing the economic impact being?
Well, I think there are very, very few departments out there right now that aren't facing some type of budget tightening or some economic impact. Even communities that have traditionally been growing communities over the last handful of years are starting to face the money crunch. And here in Cleveland, being an older stock city, we've been going through it for a number of years. But even though we've thought, hey, maybe this is starting to settle down, just in the last 2 weeks, we've lost Fortune 500 companies. Now we're waiting to see how that's going to truly impact us. But a tale of Cleveland, which is similar to other cities like ours, we're down over 200 firefighters from where we were 5 years ago, and four companies. And they're talking about further cuts. Right now, they've just cut another company that they're technically calling a browning out company, that it's open some days, staffing permitting. And the communities that surround Cleveland, specifically Lakewood, Ohio, is facing some of the same things. They're a small community with three stations, and they've cut staffing by four individuals. And we, off the air, we talked about New York. Mayor Bloomberg just mentioned that they're cutting back in the safety departments up in New York. And this is the home of 9/11. And this is the home of so many firefighter fatalities that even they're looking at their cutbacks and some of the companies that are being placed out of service are browned out. And I understand people may say, well, you know, this corner is more of a fire prevention corner. But let's look at an example in Cleveland. If the budget goes down and we have to make cuts, the dilemma that the chief here in Cleveland faced is he's the former chief of fire prevention before he stepped up to be chief of the department. And he sat there, City Hall is saying, here is your budget. Here is the finite amount of money that you're going to receive. On one hand, he knows fire prevention works. He knows that if he funds it and he has bodies there, that he can reduce the number of incidents or the impact on a community. On the other hand, he still has to respond to over 65,000 incidents a year. So he's got to do a balancing act, but at some point, he still has to respond to these incidences. So he has to draw staffing down from that Fire Prevention Bureau. He has to draw staffing down from the Education Bureau, and he has to draw staffing away from the Training Bureau to be able to staff and respond, because he's lost 200 individuals over the last 5 years. So that's a real concern that we're seeing. And it's not just here in the old Rust Belt. It's across the country.
And you bring up a very good point that, you know, when it comes to a choice of putting the red trucks on the street or staffing fire prevention, I think that's you know, the dilemma that all the fire chiefs face. And it's, you can almost guess what the response is. But I guess turning to you, Mike, you know, okay, so the chiefs draw down on the fire prevention branch and the fire marshal's office and the inspections and the education. Kind of what impact does that have on the street? What happens when that happens?
Well, certainly, you know, in some cases, it's not always evident exactly what is going to be impacted by your cuts. And I can talk about a number of different areas as well from our operational standpoint as in addition. And grants, let's talk about grants real quick. You won't have matching funds to be able to do your grants. And if you depended on grants to supply materials and some of the other supportive functions of your fire prevention program, you suddenly are now without a significant amount of resource to be able to do that. We just concluded a two-year study of senior citizen fire deaths in Montgomery County, Maryland, and this is a critical area to us that we wanted to get started to reduce the number of fire deaths we were having. So this past week, with the change of clock routine, we started our program of door-to-door, resumed that from where we had been earlier this year. And, of course, we had to go out and make sure that we had enough smoke alarms to replace alarms that either were not working or were obsolete. We had to have enough batteries to be able to replace just batteries. You're talking probably $10,000 just spent to have a cache of smoke alarms and batteries on hand for our 34 companies. We had to replace things like drills and hardware and the things that you need to logistically run a program like that. That's just one little program. If you look at our concerns about loss of overtime, in this current fiscal year, we come into this fiscal year with a deficit already, and then find even more in the fiscal forecast of revenue is not going to meet our needs, and so we are going to have to go into a savings plan at mid-year. We're working on that now, where our department, which has a $170 million budget, is going to have to cut 1% of that budget to a cost savings plan. That's almost $2 million. And $2 million equates to service and people, because you're not going to get it from an administrative staffer. That's maybe $50,000 or $60,000 with salary and benefits. You're going to get that by closing down an engine company, a truck company, or reducing service at night for you know, one of your heavy rescue companies or something like that. And it's going to take you four or five of those options to be able to get to that $2 million. So there's an impact.
And the impact, we're not going to see the impact for several years, too, are we, guys? I mean, you know, if you close an engine company today, it's an immediate impact. You don't have a company there to respond. When you start cutting back on your fire prevention activities, you know, that's something that you don't see for what? How many years? 2, 3, 4 years down the road, perhaps?
Possibly. I know one of the things that we have just really started to get up to speed, we did a reorganization of our fire prevention division and started a cost recovery process to pay for the staffing we need to get out there and make sure that our fire protection systems are working. And so dollar for dollar, we're doing permits, fees, licenses, and those kind of things to pay for the staffing, which are all uniformed firefighters, to do that work. When we did our initial study, we found that 75 to 80% of the systems that were out there were not functioning completely. Some were not working at all, and some various parts of them weren't working. So maintenance and testing is critical to them. And if you don't get to it, the building owner is probably going to forget to do it and is going to, you know, defer it.
So you know, it's interesting you bring that up, Mike. We back in 1997, I was a lieutenant on a rescue company, and we had an incident in Cleveland where the sprinkler system did not operate as designed. So the department, unfortunately, did an informal review, and it asked all the engine or every single company we had to go out and review the water-based protection systems in their running district, the known water-based protection systems. And we found over 1,000 buildings where that system was not functioning properly. And that was not, you know, pressurized testing. That was not end testing. That was simply looking to make sure there was pressure in the system, or the water was available, or the Siamese were functioning. We found over 1,000 buildings. So the department went on an aggressive campaign to try to get the sprinkler systems inspected annually. But then we hit these budget cuts again in the Fire Prevention Bureau, and it slows that down. So we turned it over, some of these, over to the battalion chiefs. And then we had companies that actually sued because they were not inspected annually. Therefore, the inspection process was unfair and not applicable, and they actually came out the victors in it. So the fire department has to look back and say, okay, now how do we go about this fairly and evenly? And with no funds. And that's, you know, I think Mike is right. We're going to see the impact down the road. It's not going to be readily apparent. We're going to find it hit and miss when there's a fire in these occupancies.
And one of the you might want to call it buzz that's being brought up, and I'm wondering if either of you guys have seen it or heard of it, is a rise in incidents of arson. Because as more of these homes, as more homeowners default on them and more homes are on the market and sitting there vacant, have you heard of any rise in arson of all of this kind of property?
Well, let me talk real quick about – Sean, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, Mike, go right ahead.
We had already started seeing, in vehicle fires. So let's just talk about vehicle fires. Yes, I anticipate that we're going to see more home fires, the potential for these set on fire. But, of course, there's been a bailout here, so maybe you're not going to get as much of that in the homes. But people are defaulting on car loans at a high rate as well. So they hire somebody to go out and torch their car, and then that gets them out of that. If nothing else, it gets them out of the payment process, mm-hmm. but it also maybe get them a judgment back to them. Now, what we've had to do is go to the insurance services offices in our state and say, look, hold payment on these things because it's a suspicious fire, and we think that maybe this is set. So what happens then if they hold a payment on that, then this person is still paying on that and they haven't gotten out of it. So sure. That's one way we've reacted to that. But I want to mention something else critical. Our fire investigators have to go to the stand in court and be able to talk about their qualifications and their certifications. And that requires ongoing feeding, if you will. They have to be able to get continuing education. They have to get new courses. They have to get their basic courses. I had three guys just graduate from police school this past July, and I haven't been able to send them to the proper cause and origin schools and some of the other things that they need to start building their resume for, so that when they do go to court, then they're challenged on their experience and knowledge, that they can say, here's the courses I've had. This makes me an expert witness at doing such and such, and so that raises their credibility, and that's critical. If we can't hire back to fill them on overtime, then I can't send them to school. So it's a real catch-22, all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point, Mike, that you made about continuing ed. I see many of the guys in our Fire Prevention Bureau who are supplying their own continuing education courses, and the department looks back at it and says, well, you know, okay, we're not paying for the courses, but you're getting overtime because of it, and that's your reward. Well, you know, that individual has to work that overtime, and, mm-hmm. you know, I don't want to get in that whole argument, but, again, our people are having to provide their own education. And what's going to happen when people can't afford to, because the economic times are hitting them also? So the departments are going to have to realize, and the cities are going to have to, I think the departments realize it. I think it's the difficulty is educating the administrators and the politicians of what proper funding of fire prevention and proper funding of fire suppression can mean to the community, or lack of funding can mean to the community. When you start to lose businesses, you lose financial funding for that city. You lose your fiscal base. Your citizens are no longer employed. They can't pay taxes. That all has a building effect onto the community. And, Mike, where this bailout's going to help, I don't know if it's going to help the large number of vacant buildings we have out there that are out there right now. We're seeing some people who, yeah, may have had trouble paying the mortgage, but from my own personal experience, what I'm witnessing is that many of these were houses that I think were intended to flip. They've been watching cable TV too much, mm-hmm. that they can get it, flip it, and make a ton of money. And they're being left with this huge stock of vacant homes that are going to require a lot of money to renovate. So we're seeing them actually getting burnt down in pockets, like they're almost clearing a block for renovation and for building. And you can see it. There are a couple of us that are very aware of it, and we're keeping track. suppression-wise, hey, they're in the triangle. They're burning these buildings down in the triangle. We know when we hear a box come in that it's probably something. And so we're trying to keep an eye out to prevent this because we're going to see our people get hurt. And that's where I have a problem with this.
Yep, I agree with you.
Well, I think just like the economic fix on a national level, there is no easy solution or easy answer to this. And I think, as we've been saying, it's something we're going to be living with here for a while. So we've really got to start looking at what kind of solutions, because I don't see a solution coming down the road real quickly. Do you guys?
No, I mean, I think it's going to have to turn around, and then it's going to have to build confidence, and people start investing again. I think they're going to go for the safest things, like municipal or government type bonds, and then they're going to venture out to the next step. But it's going to take some time.
Yeah.
We didn't get here overnight. I agree with Mike. It's going to take quite a while for us to rebuild.
Yeah. And we're going to be living with it for a little while here, the impact from it in terms of the cutbacks and the fire companies and fire prevention and everything else. So.
Hey, Ed, you know, another impact that I wanted to mention real quick, if you recall a couple of months ago, it was a jurisdiction down in Georgia who was forced to make some cuts, and their planned cuts were to reduce some of their staffing levels. And if you recall, they had gone to four-person staffing or at least increased their staffing with a SAFER grant. And what we had heard was that the federal government, because they could not fulfill their requirements or performance of the grant, the government was potentially going to make them pay that SAFER grant back, which is again another impact here. And so here the fire chief is stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know, how in the heck do I cut? If I can't cut enough to meet the needs of my boss, and yet here the federal government is saying, you know, well, you've got the SAFER grant, so you either have to continue on with that or you have to pay it back. Tough stuff.
Well, that is so many things are going to start coming out of so many different ways none of us have thought about how this is all just going to impact the fire service in so many ways.
I think that's good that the federal government's doing that, though, because I have seen politicians go in there and try to get grants earmarked for one specific purpose, and somehow those funds can be diverted to other purposes. So I think the federal government should hold local politicians to their commitment. You know, we're giving you money to protect your citizens. You need to protect your citizens.
Right.
That's the number one role of government in my mind.
Yep.
Well, we've been talking with Sean DeCrane, who's battalion chief with the Cleveland Fire Department and a member of the IFF, and Mike Love, who's the division chief and fire marshal with Montgomery County Fire Department. We're talking about the impact that the economic crisis is having on the fire service. So really appreciate you guys joining us here today on Fire Marshal's Corner. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Ed.
And we'll be covering this more in coming months on Fire Marshal's Corner. My name is Ed Kamau.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Joining us now on Fire Marshal's Corner is Chief Bill Metcalf, who's a fire chief for the North County Fire Protection District in Fallbrook, California, which is a suburb of San Diego. I really appreciate you joining us today, Chief.
I'm glad to be here.
This is continuing to take a look at the economy and the impact that the crisis is having on the fire service. And Chief Metcalf just recently did a presentation on this to a strategic summit for IFC in Washington. So, Chief, maybe you could fill us in a little bit on, I guess it's your sobering news, but on your State of the Union sort of address on the economy and its impact on the fire service.
Well, the brief Reader's Digest version is that we are in for some lean times, probably for at least another 18 months, if not 2 years or so. In the fire service, obviously everyone is aware that the economy is in trouble, and the direct impact that is having on the fire service today is that almost without exception, wherever your fire department gets its revenue, those revenue sources are declining. Across the country, fire departments depend on sales tax, and as consumer spending dries up, particularly for the big ticket items like cars and appliances, that that revenue stream is down. Other fire departments depend on property tax, and property tax is based on an assessed valuation of homes and commercial properties. And with very few exceptions across the country, property values are down, therefore assessed values are down, therefore property tax receipts are down. Some departments get their revenue from sales tax, or excuse me, from income tax, and with the joblessness being at all-time highs or at record highs right now and expected to continue there with high unemployment rates, and we're expecting that personal income taxes are going to be down. Corporate profits are off, so corporate income taxes are down. One big source of revenue for many states and local governments is capital gains tax. Capital gains taxes are taxes that are paid on money you make on the stock market, and those are drying up and going away. Here in California, their capital gains tax receipts are down 50% right now. Another place that another big source of revenue is fees, user fees. And in the fire prevention arena, I know that many, many fire prevention bureaus are funded fully or in part based on things like plan check fees or inspection fees and those types of user fees. And as the housing market slows and as the credit crunch continues and construction, both residential and commercial, is slowing dramatically, and with the fall off in construction, we're seeing dramatic declines in the number of customers that are walking in the door in Fire Prevention Bureau and paying those fees. So no matter where you look across the country, we're seeing revenue streams that pay for fire departments just drying up. And so chiefs and fire and municipal administrators across the country are being forced to look at expense cutbacks unlike any we've looked at in recent times.
And unfortunately, it just seems so often that when it comes time to cutbacks, you have to make that choice between operations and the fire marshal's office or fire prevention, and which is a tough call.
I agree with you. I think what we hear is, whether it's real or not, the perception is that the public feels that the most valuable service provided by the fire service is the men and women who are riding the fire engines and the fire engines out there on the streets. And so it's almost as if everything else is fair game. Some of the first things we see that come up when you talk to anybody who's looking at budget cuts, they start talking about across-the-board cuts in training, across-the-board cuts in travel, across-the-board cuts in non-operations related expenses. When you see layoffs, in most cases, in almost every case, you'll see administrative and prevention positions that are first on the list, because I believe the perception is that you can cut those with less impact and with less public outcry than you will get if you actually start to close fire stations or lay off firefighters.
And the impact on something like that, that's one of those short-term, long-term sort of things that you take a company out of service, that's a short-term, immediate impact. But cutting back your fire prevention efforts, you know, where you're doing less plan reviews, you're doing less training, planning, and all that sort of stuff, that's something you may not see the impact for several years down the road.
You're exactly correct. You know, we saw the dramatic effect of that fire prevention can have during the wildland fires that we had here in Southern California last fall. When we looked at homes as a result of the wildland fires we had in 2003, We did some fairly significant revisions to the fire code here in California, and particularly here in San Diego County. After last fall's fires, we looked at for the homes that were built according to the old fire codes, the pre-2000 and the pre-2003 fire codes, we had a 20% loss rate for the homes that were inside the fire perimeters. 20% of the homes were destroyed that were built according to those old codes. The homes that were built according to the new codes, the revised codes, who had fire-resistive construction and aggressive brush clearance and had been built to be fire-safe, we saw loss rates in the 2 to 3% range. Mm. And that's just one very dramatic example of we accomplished a loss rate reduction of 17 or 18% simply with prevention activities, public education, and changing how the buildings are constructed. And we couldn't throw enough fire engines at the problem to achieve that same reduction. So it's clear that our prevention efforts have dramatic impact on what we're doing in our communities. But the challenge is that I don't think the public or the politicians see that. Mm-hmm. And it's a challenge for us as fire chiefs to be able to articulate that advantage and explain it so that people understand that that's a quick fix that you're going to pay a long-term price for, and you really shouldn't go there as your first choice.
You know, and actually, that was going to be my next question: is how do we convince the policymakers of that? That it's a penny-wise, dollar-foolish sort of thing that, you know, fire prevention has long-term and significant gains, you know, and maybe this just, you know, there probably is no good answer for that, or maybe you do have some very insightful wisdom you can pass on to your peers as to how we convince the policymakers.
Well, first of all, I think is the time to be thinking about that is not when the boss is standing at your door looking for 15 or 20% budget cut. You mm-hmm. need to be thinking about the value of what you're doing and what your contribution is before that you have that budget cutting conversation. You need to be collecting the data. You need to be quantifying what you're doing. Too many of us today, I think, I said, one of the things I said to the IFC last week, it's easy to lead in good times, and instead, in those good times, instead of just relaxing and enjoying the good times, we need to be building the case for what we are doing, and we need to be collecting data, and we need to be able to explain to people what the value is of what we are doing. Mm-hmm. We saw recently what we can accomplish when we put our minds to it, with what we were able to accomplish with the vote on residential sprinklers just a few weeks ago. And when we put our mind to it, we can come up with incredible justification and explanation for why what we do works. And in that case, we were able to articulate some very credible arguments for why and how residential sprinklers reduce fire risk, improve public safety and firefighter safety, and we were able to do that. Well, we need to have those same kind of arguments in hand and ready when the budget cutters come knocking on the door. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you can scramble at the last minute and make stuff up. You have to. It has to be part of what you do every day, which is educating people about the value of the prevention programs. And I think too often they get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah. And I'd have to agree with you. That's exactly what happens. It does get lost in the shuffle of you know, everyday operations and getting the trucks on the street and all that sort of stuff. And of course, it's, you know, how do you prove a negative? You know, we didn't have a fire this week because of fire prevention, you know.
Well, I mean, but I think
how can you make that case? You know?
Sure. Well, I think there are some things that you can do. I had a developer in my office the other day talking about retrofitting sprinklers in a in a multifamily occupancy, that an apartment building that was undergoing significant renovation, and we talked about the value of early water on early detection and early water on a fire versus simple early notification and waiting for the fire department to arrive before you get water on the fire, and what difference that makes. And I think those arguments are out there to be made. I think we can put together very reasonable explanations for the value of what we do. It's just that I think we're all busy doing, we're all busy reviewing plans, we're all busy doing inspections. And somebody needs to be thinking about, okay, how do we articulate the value of what we're doing? We'd like to think that it's intuitive, but it's not. And so we need to think through, how do we make this sales pitch, whether it's to the public or to the politicians that represent them. And I think we don't spend enough time doing that.
Another follow-up that I kind of foresee coming out of this too is, you know, you're talking about the developers in there and the sprinklers. With the, you know, the collapse of the housing market, I'm sure they're going to start using the argument, well, you know, we can't afford this, people can't afford the houses now. When you start requiring sprinkler systems, you're going to push it even further out of reach of people. And while we had a great success in the IRC or ICC code recently, you know, do you foresee some pushback using that kind of logic or that kind of argument from the builders?
I'm probably the wrong person to talk about that, because we've had a mandatory residential sprinkler ordinance in my community since 2001, and the builders know it's there, and they accept it as a cost of doing business, and we no longer get pushback. When I do, it's in the context of what I just mentioned with some of the retrofit requirements. But I think that the cost of sprinklers is I guess I know I'm preaching to the choir here. It's a red herring that gets used as where it's not really a valid issue. Those of us old timers on here may recall back in the days when there were the federal government was talking about mandating seatbelts in cars, and the auto industry revolted and said that the public will never pay the increased costs of adding seatbelts or airbags to cars. Well, today they're a marketing point, and the automakers are out there bragging about how safe their vehicles are. And I think it's a matter of making the philosophical or the mental adjustment that, no, this is the right thing to do, it's the safe thing to do, and we're going to do it. And in our experience here, where we've been doing residential sprinklers since 2001, it no longer even shows up on the radar screen as an issue. It's just a fact of life.
Well, I guess you might be the right person to ask that, you know. Has it killed the housing sales there?
Absolutely not. Absolutely.
I mean, yeah, you're probably building great guns, right, aren't you?
Absolutely. And, well, we were.
Yeah. Yeah, like everybody.
And it'll come back. And here, it's, you know, when I'm out in my community and talking to people in the community, when people are in the housing market, they're now looking for a home that has residential sprinklers, and the absence of residential sprinklers is actually seen as a negative when they're looking at a property.
Yeah, that's excellent.
So I think that will some communities get that pushback? Absolutely. I think the research that was done that showed the average cost of an installed residential sprinkler system is, what was it, $1.61 per square foot is an indication about, in the overall scheme of things, that's awfully cheap protection, and I think in the overall cost of building a home, it's not an issue. Now, I think the issue that we've got to deal with, and it is an issue here, a battle that we continue to fight on this issue, is the water providers and the fees.
Right.
the excessive fees that they're providing for to provide the necessary water supply for sprinkler systems, and that's a huge issue. But the sprinklers themselves are no longer an issue. I think once you get it done, we're not getting any more pushback.
Well, we've been talking with Chief Bill Metcalf from the North County Fire Protection District in Fallbrook, California, and the chief is also the treasurer for the International Association of Fire Chiefs. And he's presenting us with his perspective on how this economic downturn is going to be impacting the fire service, which is one that's going to be here for a number of years and one that's going to have significant ramifications. So we really appreciate you taking the time, Chief, to join us and fill us in. Not good news, but certainly news that we need to hear, that's for sure.
You're very welcome. I'm glad to be here. And I guess my final message is that this too shall pass. There are signs that the housing market is turning around in many, many communities. The government bailout programs are starting to loosen up credit, and things will get better. But we are going to be facing some lean times for the next 18 months to 2 years.
Well, we'll just have to see what happens now that we have a new administration coming in and see what direction everything takes. And we can only hope for the best that just turns around for everybody. So, well, we've had a really interesting show today with some great information from Alan Perdue at the International Association of Fire Chiefs Fire Life Safety Section, and Sean DeCrane, Mike Love, and Chief Bill Metcalf talking about the economic impact. So thanks for joining us this month on Fire Marshal's Corner. My name is Ed Camau.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.